Welcome to the East Traumacast. This program was brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Advancing science, fostering relationships, and building careers. Now, on to the Traumacast.
Before we get started, I'd like to say thank you to Chemonetics for their generous and unrestricted grant for the Educational Resource Committee and Traumacast. I'm Tatiana Cardenas, trauma, burns, and acute care surgeon at Dell Medical School and Dell Seton Medical Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Today, we're going to talk about resuscitation of the traumatically injured patient in the operating room. I'm joined by two moderators from our very own Educational Resources Committee, as well as a distinguished panel of guests. So I'll let everybody go ahead and introduce themselves.
Hello, I'm Jake Edwards. I'm a trauma acute care surgeon at University of Tennessee Medical Center, and I'm happy to be here today to help moderate this TraumaCast.
Hi, I'm Zach Kassim. I'll be co-moderating with Jake. I'm an emergency medicine physician and surgical intensivist at the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm excited to have our two guests here to discuss this topic.
I'm Marissa Mary. I am an anesthesiologist and surgical intensivist at Dell Medical School.
I'm Jeremy Cannon. I'm a trauma surgeon in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania.
All right. So today we'll be discussing the challenges faced by both anesthesiologists and surgeons during the operative resuscitation of the trauma patient. Most of the audience, if not all, have experienced differences of opinion and challenges in communication while operating on the traumatically injured patient who needs ongoing resuscitation. Today, we hope to address some of these challenges and explore some solutions. And with that, let's get started. So Jeremy and Marissa, what are some of the challenges that you all have faced when actively resuscitating a trauma patient in the OR?
I mean, I can go first. I think for us, it's really a lot of times it's understanding kind of what's happened before the patients get to us. We always try and send at least one person from our team down to the emergency room so that we can hear sign out kind of from the paramedics or EMT team. And then from there, it's really kind of quickly just assessing what's going on, right? I think very similar, we take a kind of a much more step back or a passive role in the, you know, immediate evaluation of resuscitation. But I think what we're looking at is, you know, does this patient's airway look patent? Are they able to talk? Are they struggling? If they are breathing, you know, are they moving air kind of cleanly versus, you know, sounding stridorous? You know, saying, is there an injury to the face, right? Is there blood in the face? Are they vomiting? And then just looking at, you know, hemodynamic stability and kind of the mechanism of injury, right? A penetrating blunt is different for us as well as the surgeons.
So. Yeah, for me as a surgeon, that's very well framed. And it's a tenuous time in the patient's course. And there's a lot of data and information that needs to be communicated very quickly. So I try to make eye contact with the attending anesthesiologist. We have a framework for a quick handoff so that we can try to communicate that information in an efficient and comprehensive manner. But there are lots of considerations from, you know, what blood product resuscitation has the patient received already, what hemostatic adjuncts have been given or may not have been administered. You heard about the airway considerations. You know, in some cases, the patient may have already been intubated in the trauma bay by, say, an emergency medicine team, or maybe sort of teetering on the edge sort of barely holding on from a physiologic standpoint and yet may need to be intubated in the operating room. And then you also have to consider where the injuries are. You know, does this patient have a potential, say, cardiac injury and pending tamponade? So there's a lot that goes into that first couple minutes when the patient rolls into the trauma OR.
You guys kind of touch on a couple of topics that I just wanted to expand on a little bit. You know, there's one is having the eyes on the patient when they first come into the trauma bay. So some places have anesthesia responding to these high level trauma activations and some don't. For example, our facility The emergency medicine team will be managing the airway in collaboration with the trauma surgical team. Should it be kind of the default, even if they're not actively participating in the resuscitation, for the anesthesiology team to come down? And if there is, you mentioned a handoff, is there a structure to that handoff? And if not, should there be, to be able to pass on kind of time critical information in often a pressured environment?
In terms of whether or not we should be there, I think it should be the default. I think the reality is such that, you know, at nights, nights, weekends, I think when all centers are shorter staffed and there may be cases running, some of our level two trauma facilities also have obstetrics with one anesthesiologist and a few either residents or CRNAs on staff. That's not always the case, but I do think it should be the default, right? You get a lot of information by seeing how a patient looks in the trauma bay, hearing what they've received product or adjunct wise en route, and then in the trauma bay. In terms of a handoff, I tend to hold the belief that I feel like all handoffs are best if they're structured, right? Because these teams change, even for teams that are relatively tight, meaning a small group of anesthesiologists and a small group of surgeons, pointing out and identifying what are the primary things that we need to know to make decisions in the first, let's say, 15 minutes of the operating room will just make things smoother and better for the patient.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Marissa said. I think it is ideal to have anesthesiology presence in the trauma bay, the default. But, you know, each center and hospital system is going to have perhaps a unique situation, and the realities of clinical practice are that, you know, they may be pulled in many different directions and it may not be possible. But I think it does facilitate communication. Having seen it structured a couple of different ways, I really do prefer that handoff. So we're starting with sort of a shared mental model of what the patient looks like, where they are in their trajectory. If it's a steep downward trajectory, then, you know, we know, and everyone in the trauma OR, you know, will, I think, better understand that this is a no kidding, do or die, serious hustle up situation. Whereas other situations, not that we want to be lulled into complacency, but it may not be as time pressured, and you can sort of get a sense for that with just, you know, the eyeball inspection. But, you know, if that's not physically possible to have anesthesiology presence in the trauma bay, then I think a structured handoff is very helpful to sort of ensure that critical information is passed along.
Kind of moving on from the initial evaluation of the patient and the handoff in the OR, can I talk a little bit more about like some of the science of resuscitation in the OR? We all know that a balanced resuscitation of product, a 1-to-1-to-1, PRVCs, FFP, platelets, is the goal for our resuscitation. However, I find that it's been a challenge to get that to continue on in the OR. What do you think are some of the struggles that lead to that gap?
I've had an interest in both the science of balanced resuscitation and then the practical aspects of implementing that. You hinted that it can be challenging. There can be differing levels of understanding of the strength of the evidence. There is a lot to attend to early in the first several minutes of a resuscitation. And then you have to think about the logistical aspects from the blood bank. You know, for example, is the first cooler from MTP there on hand? Has the massive transfusion protocol or massive exsanguination protocol actually been activated? And so, you know, although the bullet point list of ideal practices that go into damage control resuscitation are easy to understand, it ultimately turns out to be a pretty complicated and challenging set of precepts to actually implement. So I can talk more in a little bit about some approaches we've developed to address that. But I think it is very challenging and I think it can lead to sort of deviations from the ideal because it is so challenging.
I guess I can speak to that. We recently looked back actually at our resuscitations and we made an OR intraoperative database of our cases, kind of saying to look at the idea of, hey, for patients who are or are not given a balanced resuscitation, what are the outcomes and are there differences? And I think what we were surprised at is that the vast majority of our patients basically received a one-to-one-to-one resuscitation. And there were, you know, I think the biggest difference is platelets, right? Because you either, in our standpoint, give six or you don't. But it was incredibly close. And we actually thought about, what have we done as kind of a team to do this? Because we actually have 100 docs in our group. We are a private practice group that covers a level one trauma center. And while there are probably 15 to 20 of us that primarily work there, I mean, we have people who are primarily PD anesthesiologists and otherwise actually covering call. And we were happy to see that kind of almost standardization. For us, what's really led to that has been that our MTP cases, there's sort of an understanding that you don't get another one until you've used what's in there, right? And so for us, that kind of is one-to-one-to-one. And yeah, you can call for it, but you make sure you give everything. And I think it's basically on our anesthesia carts and otherwise. So I think, you know, we just system-wise have had that be relatively easy. We also have a system that actually the trauma surgeon set up where we have one of the ICU nurses, a float nurse, come and assist with resuscitations if it's felt to be a true MTP, meaning the patients are going to need to go through more than one round.
That's you bring up actually some good points that I think we'll circle back to, but just keeping to the science of the resuscitation. So you are aiming to maintain your resuscitation in a balanced product resuscitation. Maybe the blood bank's kind of struggling with the keeping up on that. And you're, from Marissa, from the on your side of the curtain, you see that the alarm is alarms are beeping on the monitor and the pressure is tanking. Jeremy's trying his best to get the bleeding under control, but there's some time period where you need to temporize. So should you be administering pressors? So what are both of your thoughts on the use of pressors in these situations?
We do use pressors. We try not to. We use pressors on induction quite frequently. And then I think one of the big surprises for our trauma surgeons when we looked at this interop database is how frequently we do employ them. You know, it's not, we rarely have patients, let's say, on drips, and we try and communicate with our surgeons, but we use them while we're trying to catch up. I do think that we have an ideal of some degree of permissive hypotension. We definitely don't want to be in a situation where we're bordering what we think might lead to kind of something catastrophic or an arrest just while waiting for products.
I'm glad you brought up the concept of permissive hypotension. The benefits of that in the operating room have been called into question. A follow-up analysis by Maddox and his team showed that it does not improve survival and, in fact, may cause harm. So the blood pressure parameters have to be a little tighter, and you have the ability to monitor labs and lactate, for example.
Yeah.
And I think there is a role for vasopressors. Again, you don't want to overshoot and, as they say, pop the clot. I think that is a reality. You can overshoot. The AVERT shock trial suggests that if you give vasopressin as really more of a hormonal replacement, but it certainly also has a vasopressor benefit as well, your blood product utilization will likely be less. And so if we're in the midst of a big resuscitation and you know, I have just a minute while my hand is on the bleeding vessel, I'll sometimes ask, you know, are we on vasopressors? If so, have you considered starting vasopressin specifically? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I'm asking about blood products and how that's progressing along together with adjuncts as well.
I will say we also try and remember, I think when you talk about adjuncts, I think it is useful to remember that, you know, hypocalcemia is common in these patients. We've actually debated putting in, you know, a gram of calcium chloride into each round of MTP, just as kind of a reminder so that people don't have to actually think about it. And as reluctant, I think, as we are to use, you know, bicarb boluses at times, I find like when patients are hypotensive and acidotic, they do help at least in a fair number of our cases.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up both calcium and bicarb.
Yeah.
Because that's at UT Medical Center, that's what we do, is we have a gram of calcium chloride or 2 grams of calcium gluconate in our MTP boxes. So it reminds whoever's administering to give the calcium. But the bicarb issue is, I just want to know that you all have given the bicarb, right? Because then when you read out the last ISTAT or last gas or whatever, it really does play an effect. Is this artificial because you just gave bicarb, or is this, are we actually improving the physiology?
So Jeremy and Marissa, you talked about the use of calcium for like a typical MTP where you have component therapy. Marissa, you said giving a gram of calcium with each box, but as we kind of move more to using whole blood, is there a difference in how we should be administering the calcium to patients receiving whole blood from the get-go?
You know, we've started using whole blood here in Austin. I have less experience with it. I feel pretty comfortable saying that, you know, if we do it for rounds of MTP, at least personally, that I'm going to end up relying on blood gases a bit more frequently to titrate.
Zaf, I think it really depends on where you are in the resuscitation. Are you in an empiric phase, or are you in a sort of a a more of a controlled setting where you have the ability to get those blood gases? Personally, I will give a gram of calcium up front as I'm reaching for the whole blood in the trauma bay, and then as we transition to sort of the sustainment mode up in the operating room, we do tend to, our anesthesia team does tend to rely on blood gas values. But if you get into a situation where it's just pouring out and you're pouring blood in, I think it is important to keep up, because you'll lag behind if you continue to just use blood gases, in my opinion.
This kind of brings me up to another topic, that use of Cell Saver or auto transfusions, right? So Cell Saver, it's not a full component product resuscitation. And sharing that knowledge and education with anesthesia and your team, how do you balance out that resuscitation when using Cell Saver?
I can start. So there's some questions about Cell Saver. Specifically, should you use it if there's a bowel injury? Is it a waste of time if you don't know if there's a bowel injury? So we actually include Cell Saver in our MTP activation that sends notice to our perfusionist, who are responsible for managing the Cell Saver. Our OR nurses are able to get all the tubing set up and hit the go button, so it's available early on. I haven't seen any overwhelming evidence that you're going to commit your patient to a horrific septic death if you use Cell Saver, if there's just a little bit of, say, gastric contents or something. Now, if it's just like an ocean of stool, I wouldn't try to salvage, you know, a couple red cells out of that. But if it's mostly blood and maybe a little bit of contamination, I think there's no overwhelming evidence that I've seen that it's harmful to the patient to try to salvage that blood. There's also concern about what you are mixing the blood with. You know, there in our system, there's heparin that gets mixed with the blood, but then it allegedly gets rinsed off. I've never seen a head-to-head comparison between, say, a unit of red cells from the Red Cross and a unit of Cell Saver blood that's about to be hung for the patient. You know, what's the coagulation profile of that blood? But I don't think it's so overwhelmingly coagulopathic that it's going to cause harm. So I really see it as like a, you know, a unit of red blood cells, the equivalent of a unit of red blood cells. There's also questions about cell salvage from chest tubes. In an austere environment where you don't have a lot of blood and you're sort of, you know, just trying to use all the resources you have available to you, it might be okay. But there's been some nice work from UT San Antonio that shows that that salvage product is actually wildly coagulopathic, and the cells are probably not all that functional. They get sort of fractured and beat up in the whole process of exsanguination into the chest and then drainage into the pleurovac and then going through the Cell Saver. That it's probably not the ideal kind of stuff that you'd want to give. Can you make the same argument about Cell Saver? Yeah, I don't adamantly hate Cell Saver. I will use it. I don't see it as like, you know, the thing that's going to make or break the difference in the patient living or not. But I think it can save you a couple units of red cells. Interested to hear your thoughts, Marissa.
Yeah, I mean, we don't employ it here, I think. So what I'm saying is more theoretical. I think like large volume lost cardiac cases, it's a great potential adjunct, but I wouldn't necessarily think about relying on it. But I will say, and from other areas like cardiac, we transfuse based on, you know, what we're seeing in front of us and what our tags or gases tell us. And then we typically, just based on timing, drip in the cell saver at the end. And my guess is that's kind of what would happen if we employed it in trauma.
That being said, the communication between anesthesia and surgery during the operation, what anesthesia is doing, what the surgeon's finding, how do you all see that dynamic in the operating room, and how do you do that information sharing?
The exchange of information, I think, is critical, but also very challenging. And I think it is important to again, share that information across the blood-brain barrier. One idea I've had, and just by way of disclosure, I have a pending patent on this capability, but we've developed the concept called the Blood Navigator, where it's like a scoreboard, and it demonstrates how much plasma, red cells, whole blood, platelets have been given. It also tells you where you are in the administration of adjuncts. Has the calcium been given? We do have a bicarb option there, you know, really for communication, not so much encouraging the use of bicarb. TXA, and then you can look at laboratory guided hemostasis. What are your TEG results? What are your Rotem results? And what have we done in response? Critically important, but also very challenging. You know, there's a lot of data to pass back and forth. At the same time, I'll just encourage my surgical colleagues to maintain communication from our standpoint. You know, what's going on in the field? Where are we packing the liver? Is the spleen out? Do I have a clamp on the aorta that I've moved down from the supraceliac to the sort of infrarenal location? You know, where are we in the sort of progression of surgical hemostasis? Also very important to point that out.
I'd like to say, I think we spend a lot of time listening, right, and trying to understand kind of what oftentimes, you know, we have a teaching facility. So, you know, what's the surgeon saying to the resident? Because we can pick up a lot of what's happening and whether or not, you know, there's source control or what's going on from that. I will say I hadn't realized how much we communicated until COVID, when we brought those loud fans in and none of us could hear anything, and how much it actually really impacted what we do. I mean, I think we're really lucky. I feel like, in particular, since I work in the trauma ICU, I know our attending surgeons really well. And there's just free-flowing communication, respect that goes off on both sides. And I think that's really important, quite frankly, right? Because our CRNAs say that they worked in places that are not this kind of open and welcoming, and that they have much less of an idea of what's going on in other places than we do at Dell.
I'll say that was one of the real challenges for me as well during the pandemic, was trying to communicate through an N95.
Yeah.
I tend to be a little bit of a low talker, and you add an N95, a surgical mask, and you know, the background noise in the operating room, that made it very, very difficult.
One of the things I guess I want to be more specific about was whenever you get your set of labs from your iStat or whatever instrument you're using to get your quick gas, right? Or whenever you're starting to go on pressors, do you immediately notify the surgical team that you're doing these things, or these are where the results are, so it can be a team collaborative on resuscitation? Or is it just you make the medical decisions based off the information that you have, and then as you gain new information from the surgeon, that alters your course?
I think it depends on the tenor in the operating room, honestly. Like, if it seems like they're struggling and they're really focused on what they're doing, I feel like I can kind of focus on what I'm doing to support the patient from our end, kind of without involving them, not because they couldn't contribute, but because I don't want to dilute their focus. If there's a question, or if we're really struggling, I'll be the first to say, hey, this is what our pressure is. We got this back on the gas. It's unexpected. But if it's just an incredibly, you know, sick, bleeding patient and the labs look really bad, but kind of expectedly bad, and we're working on it, then I feel okay with that.
One thing that we've done in our operating room is always ensure that we've got two monitors, at least two monitors with the vital signs on them. And that, you know, helps my aging eyes, so I'm not straining to see the small monitor up above the ether screen. But then I think also just maintain situational awareness. You know, we see it in the cardiac ORs all the time. Why shouldn't we have a similar sort of monitor set up in the trauma OR?
I think that segues nicely into kind of the concept of situational awareness. And these are high stress kind of situations, especially kind of the index operation after someone arrives in hemorrhagic shock from their traumatic injury. And so we touched on this a little bit, where you mentioned that it might be useful to have an ICU nurse come in and assist with parts of the logistics of the resuscitation. But is it possible, or does it happen where the anesthesiologist becomes so engrossed in what they're doing, the surgeon so engrossed in what they're doing, that you run the risk of losing sight of the overall resuscitation? And should there be any additional help, for example, another anesthesiologist or maybe even a surgical intensivist who comes to the OR to assist? And what do you guys think of kind of adding additional resources to help with these really sick, dynamic patients?
I can just comment. We have an expected pause, not like a formal timeout, but like, hey, you know, what direction are we going? With regards to blood products. So after the fourth cooler, you know, especially in the time when we were in a blood supply crisis, that was sort of a trigger to ask the trauma and anesthesia teams to reassess the sort of viability of the patient and sort of the global injury burden. And we also asked that they involve the trauma medical director or someone in the trauma leadership to say, hey, you know, this is where we are. Either we think that we can salvage the situation and keep going, or, you know, we're sort of wondering if we're hitting a wall and just sort of pouring more good resources after bad. I'll say that, you know, the need to do that has been rather infrequent. In fact, I can't think of a time where we actually said, okay, you got to terminate these efforts after the fourth cooler because it's completely futile. But it at least injected sort of a pre-planned pause and took some of the, you know, made it a little more dispassionate and took some of the, you know, emotion out of that that situation. And I think at least theoretically facilitated some difficult conversations.
Yeah, we don't have anything formal like that. What I can say, just kind of on a daily or routine basis, is that for all of our traumas, they're announced within our group. And so we have, at the bare minimum, at least two CRNAs and a physician. And most of the time, when the trauma comes, there's two to three docs in the room, just for the initial setup, line placement if it's needed, resuscitation. And then, you know, de facto, usually one person kind of stands back and keeps that sort of forest through the trees eye mindset. It isn't formal, and it definitely won't necessarily be happening at 2 a.m. if there's just one doc on call. But I think as a culture, at least where we are here and where I've been previously in Houston, is the idea that kind of having more of us putting our heads together around something, especially if it's not going well or routinely, is beneficial.
Kind of talking about your resource utilization and trauma patient just keeps bleeding, and you're entering into that triangle of death. What conversations are you all having? Is anesthesia saying, hey, we're getting acidotic? What are we at down there? We're also hypothermic. Are you having vagalopathic bleeding? Should we stop? Is that encouraged at your institutions for anesthesia to say, hey, should we stop and go to the ICU to resuscitate?
I think so. I've always felt comfortable having those discussions. Especially we have three sites where we cover trauma, two level two trauma centers, and at Del Seton, that's level one. And I think really almost without exception, there is pretty solid communication going back and forth. Or there are times, honestly, where we don't necessarily move to the ICU, but we say that we need to catch up. Like pause on whatever you're doing or just try and get some control and allow us to catch up.
Yeah, I think that's also important to have that open communication, especially if you've got an aortic clamp on or you've got a balloon inflated somewhere. And then as you're, as a surgeon deciding about damage control versus definitive reconstruction, it's really, really important to have those discussions. And, you know, either the surgical or anesthesia team should feel empowered to initiate that discussion for sure.
So what if there's disagreement? So say the anesthesiologist feels strongly that we need to slow down or stop temporarily to do something, or they choose a therapy that they think is in the best interest of the patient, but the surgeon disagrees. So how do you address that, and how do you resolve that potential for conflict?
I think it really is predicated on something Marissa said earlier, and that's the trust between the teams. You have to know, I think ideally, know personally and know well your anesthesia colleagues. I think you have to be able to voice disagreement, work through that. Hopefully it's not violent disagreement. As one of our, I heard the Navy Surgeon General mention that term, we're in violent agreement. I'm like, that's a weird way to put it. Anyway, yeah, that I think predicated on a relationship of trust, you can work through most differences of opinion and come to a mutually agreed upon solution that's in the patient's best interest. Interested to hear what you think, Marissa.
No, I'd agree. I mean, right, if it comes to a point of disagreement, it means that most likely there is not an easy or obvious solution, right? Because that would have already happened. And I think at that point, you really just have to trust your colleagues, right? And it's kind of like almost anything. The stakes are higher, but I think in most sort of quandaries in life, you say, we're going to try this. And if it doesn't work out, we'll reevaluate.
This is a good segue, you know, this conversation, this question that Jeremy and Marissa have just answered. I often find that those times of miscommunication aren't with the door-busting trauma that is truly a massively exsanguinated patient. I find that sometimes happens in the patient that's fine, and then they transition into this, oh no, not so fine anymore in the operating room. And so my question is there a trigger that y'all have, because obviously the communication is going to be very different for the massively transfused patient that's dying from jump versus the one that's totally fine and now all of a sudden becomes not fine. Is there a communication trigger that you guys have or system that you have to discuss, you know, back and forth with each other, surgeon and anesthesia?
I would say, you know, intermittently checking in on the blood gases, if the pH is trending in the wrong direction, if the lactate is not either correcting or starts again to trend in the wrong direction. Those are my sort of blunt instruments for, you know, troubleshooting the situation.
Yeah. I think that I agree that some of the hardest conversations we have is when we have to say, like, what's going on, because something's not right, right? And I think when I feel the most stressed is when I don't know what the problem is, right? Because I, you know, whether or not it's a fixable problem, at least when you know the problem, you can start making steps to correct it, right? In conjunction with your surgical team. When you don't know what the issue is where we run, I think, into more trouble. And I do think that's honestly, as you put it, like where trust comes in, right? When you work with surgeons day in, day out, who you know, it's a lot easier to kind of trust them and trust their, you know, kind of input than someone you may have just met.
Just a couple of thoughts for surgeons that may find themselves in these situations. Thoracoabdominal trauma, missed injuries, those are some of the things that, you know, can really crop up as precipitating this kind of unexpected trajectory. Bleeding from a scalp wound, bleeding into an extremity or bleeding onto the floor from an extremity that's under the drapes. I mean, those are things that I've seen lead to this sort of unexpected trajectory. You have to sort of step back and, you know, generally get back into that 30,000 foot view mode and see, okay, what am I missing? You know, could it be a pneumothorax that I didn't appreciate is the, are the diaphragms billowing into my field? Does the patient have evolving pericardial tamponade for some reason? And am I losing blood unexpectedly or in a place that, you know, I'm not seeing under the drapes? So just a few things that might help you troubleshoot a situation like this if you find yourself in it.
And I'll just add to that, I think one of the things that we run into is that in trauma, oftentimes the answer is blood, right? I mean, in resuscitation. And I think, you know, especially as we start taking care of more and more elderly trauma patients, that's not always the case. Or as you said, right, there are other etiologies like a tension pneumothorax or something else that's missed. And I do think that there are times where I've been a little bit hesitant. You know, I'm like, the gas looks okay in terms of, you know, yeah, we know that the hemoglobin can lag and whatnot. But should we be looking for something else other than bleeding? I think that's actually sometimes when we end up with a little bit more sort of disagreement or tension, because it's scary to miss bleeding, but it's also scary to really over transfuse, resuscitate someone who might, you know, just have congestive heart failure, severe congestive heart failure at baseline, and we just never even knew it.
Another example that I'll give just real quick is the combination of hemorrhagic shock and neurogenic shock.
Yeah.
From a patient that has, say, penetrating trauma that involves the spinal cord. Yeah. So clearly they've got sources of hemorrhage, say, in the chest or the abdomen. You're addressing that, yet their pressure just is not responding. And you fill the tank and fill the tank and keep filling the tank, you can definitely overdo it.
Yeah.
With over resuscitation, over transfusion. So, you know, if there's any possibility that a bullet trajectory could have gone through the spinal canal, think about the combination of hemorrhagic shock and neurogenic shock.
Yeah, it kind of brings me to, you know, some of our adjuncts that we use in the ICU to look at how our resuscitation is going, right? Is ultrasound is a big, big, big component now.
Yeah.
So thinking about that in the OR, we could, what about the utility of doing TEEs on our trauma patients when we're actively resuscitating them to look at our resuscitation status?
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say that. I at one point was kind of following a group, I think based out of Australia, that was really into resuscitative TEE, especially for cardiac arrest. And then I think had done some publications, I don't know if it was formal peer-reviewed, but definitely kind of webinars and small little videos on using it in trauma. I think it's a really interesting idea. I can't come from the cardiac world before I was here, you know, and we used to put them in the ICU all the time when we were struggling. You know, I probably one a night or, you know, a couple a week just saying, hey, we're not moving where we think we should be. What are we doing? You know, and you can actually see the impact you have when you can measure stroke volume, when you administer blood products, you can look at, you know, the dynamics of the LV and RV when, you know, if you happen to use pressors and whatnot or inotropes. I don't know of groups that are doing it. I'm sure that there are, but I think it's a really interesting to think about, you know, moving forward as we start using kind of more imaging in real time.
You know, it's interesting, there for a while was this TEE probe that you could just place in the patient in the ICU and leave there and then intermittently, you know, sort of spot check what's going on. I think, you know, from a surgical intensivist standpoint, I never felt facile enough with what I was looking at to really be able to make a difference. And then there was this big upsurge in, you know, bedside point of care ultrasound, you know, transthoracic or transabdominal, that really sort of, you know, in some ways supplanted or obviated the need for that indwelling TEE imaging. But in the operating room, I think, you know, to me, it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's an opportunity for exploring further.
Yeah.
I think that circles us nicely to how we've kind of evolved in becoming facile at trauma, and that's training. And so, you know, what, from the surgical perspective, I think the audience clearly knows, and several members are either, you know, board certified surgical critical care or on that pathway. So there's clearly a need after surgical training to undergo additional training in trauma surgery. Is that the same case with anesthesiology? What kind of training does the average resident come out with at the end of their training? And should there be additional training for you to be able to manage these sick trauma patients in a level one trauma center. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. You know, I was actually thinking a lot about this. I know someone who went and did a trauma fellowship out at USC and had really enjoyed it. I really do think it depends on where you trained, right? I mean, I started off in Boston, actually transferred from my husband, so ended up doing the majority of my training at Ben Taub, where we had a fantastic trauma experience. So I felt very comfortable coming out. And then I did a SICU fellowship and ended up doing cardiac. So I felt very comfortable kind of resuscitating patients and whatnot. I do think there's a benefit of focused training and trauma, though. I don't know if it's necessarily a year-long fellowship, but, you know, I was thinking about things that are different. You know, and beyond even the resuscitation, I think a lot of the stuff that we think about is sort of what are other sort of trauma etiologies that lead to decompensation. Exactly, like Jeremy was saying, around sort of keeping neurogenic shock in the back of your mind. And then honestly, airways are really different, right? You can want to do an awake intubation on someone who can't open their mouth because, let's say, they have a large tumor or whatnot. But that's really different than having their airway being obstructed with blood and you know, questions of things like a tracheal injury. And having that stuff in mind when you receive a patient is important. I think most people receive probably, especially at larger centers, probably receive some pretty good trauma training. So I don't necessarily think it's something that requires a fellowship, let's say the way that, you know, cardiac or you know, neonatal pediatrics does. But I do think, especially in terms of CME or really good onboarding, let's just say, for people who are moving into a trauma environment and haven't spent a lot of time in one.
Yeah, I would agree that really exposure is the key to both certain level of comfort and then success. And we see that in our CRNAs as well. You know, a fairly new CRNA that hasn't seen a lot of trauma, clearly their stress level is typically much higher than a seasoned CRNA that's been there, done that, that, you know, knows the drill of how to, you know, implement the MTP resuscitation, knows about adjuncts. So it's really, I think, a familiarization at a comfort level. I would, you know, suggest that folks that have done an anesthesia critical care fellowship and or a cardiac critical care fellowship, I think, you know, are well poised to be really experts at resuscitation and can contribute in important ways, not only at the bedside individual patient level, but in research, resuscitation research. One of my proudest moments was to work with one of our anesthesia colleagues who was doing a critical care fellowship. She went on to do cardiac anesthesia, but she had one of the landmark papers in hypocalcemia, or really calcium derangement. We found that both hypocalcemia and hypercalcemia early post-trauma were strongly predictive of poor outcomes. And so Emily McKay is her name. She has gone on to just be a phenomenal clinical cardiac and trauma resuscitation anesthesiologist. So I think if that's any sort of example, you know, those folks with that experience and background, I think are well poised to contribute clinically to patient care and then also to the literature.
Yeah, I do think there's less academic or sort of research-based collaboration than you would expect, given the fact that we are side to side taking care of patients on a daily basis.
Yeah, whenever I was doing a lit review on this topic for a talk I gave not too long ago, it was very dichotomous. Like either it was the anesthesia literature or surgery literature. There was very few programs that combined their two services and efforts on research.
Something about that drape that's hanging between us.
I know. So one of the things I think that would also be kind of beneficial is, you kind of alluded to this, Marissa, with, you know, continuing medical education opportunities being shared between the two divisions or two departments as well, right? Because I recently gave a grand rounds to our anesthesia department and they all came up to me afterwards, like, that was good to get inside the mind of a surgeon, because we never know really what you're thinking. Should there be some formalized expectations for continuing medical education for anesthesia related to trauma topics specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think I have no relationship to the kind of maintenance of certification for anesthesia. I'm putting it out there. But they actually allow us to kind of say what your practice is. And, you know, prepping for this or thinking about this actually made me realize, you know, we say whether or not we practice critical care, or whether or not we practice obstetrics, you know, at certain percentages, or pediatrics, but trauma is not typically listed on there. It's kind of just considered a bread and butter of general anesthesia. And I do think it is differentiated itself enough that it should be something that is specifically targeted. And I do think the literature, right, the science behind trauma, traumatic injury and resuscitation is advanced enough that it should be that way. I'm biased. I feel really strongly that the internships, whether or not it's transitional or built into it, should probably have about 6 months of general surgery, which is not a popular opinion. But I did a surgery internship, and I really feel like it, honestly, it helps me on a daily basis. So
I find that, just to key off of that, I find that our radiology residents who have done a transitional or a surgical internship really are easy to communicate with. They, again, have that shared mental model, that they just, you can tell that they've been through, a significant exposure experience to surgery and trauma. And then I'll say, just to follow up on Jake's comment, or rather question, I think taking opportunities to cross-pollinate between disciplines is important. It does take some intentionality and take some work, but it will pay dividends. So I've given, many educational sessions for our CRNAs. We have our trauma liaison from the anesthesiology department come and give guest lectures, both on resuscitation and his perspective on that. And then we've got other anesthesiologists who have given talks on lung rescue. Their, cardiac anesthesia is involved in our lung rescue, and some of our trauma patients end up needing lung rescue. And so it's great, great synergy and an opportunity for, again, cross-pollination to have them come and speak with our group, and then our leaders in the trauma program share knowledge and perspectives with their team as well.
Just while we're talking about cross-pollination, Jeremy, I'll ask you in particular, and I'm not sure if Marissa has a similar experience, but you've had a significant experience in the military as well. And so has there been opportunity? I know there's been a lot of talk about military-civilian discussions in the trauma surgical world, but has there been similar discussions of the lessons that the anesthesiology team have learned from military conflict to bring to civilian practice, and what's the lay of the land there?
Yeah, it's really a central part of our discussions as we talk about MIL-CIV partnerships, and the anesthesia providers globally, either anesthesiologists or CRNAs or some combination, are central to our success. From a system standpoint, from a resource utilization standpoint, from a resuscitation standpoint, and also, even long-range transport. So folks with anesthesia critical care are eligible for CCAT certification and can be involved in long-range transport. So lots of opportunities, and yes, absolutely, it's a central part of our military vision and focus for the future, for sure.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us today. It has been very insightful, and I hope the audience has got to take away some great tidbits from this.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks. This was great.
That wraps up another episode of TraumaCast, brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Visit east.org to check out all the great educational and career development resources we have to offer. And make sure you subscribe to the TraumaCast series so you don't miss any of our exciting upcoming programs or interviews. If you're searching for cutting-edge science, professional education, networking, and career development, remember, all you need to do is look to the east.